Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, an update on current Alzheimer's research. But first, if you've ever played the computer puzzle game Tetris, you know how it is. It starts off slowly. The pieces drift down, and you have maybe, 10, 15 seconds to think, position, spin, drop the pieces into position. Players have to take in the board. They have to assess the piece and play. You have to make a snap decision. But what happens? It gets faster. And at the top levels of play, pieces fall down the screen in a second or less. Can that teach us something about how the brain works in learning, cognition, or decision-making? Wayne Gray is a professor of cognitive science at Rensselaer Polytech in Troy, New York, and for the past 3 years, he's been bringing a team of cognitive science researchers to the Classic Tetris World Championships. And this year's tournament starts next weekend. He'll be there attending for the fourth year. Welcome back to the program.
Why, hello. Thank you.
Now, so you're going to the championship for the fourth year. Tell us what it's like there.
Wow. Well, especially our first year, it was just chaos and confusion from our perspectives. The first day of the tournament, first 2 days of the tournament, people were trying to qualify to get a slot on the championship playoff schedule, which they had 40 openings for. And people could play all day as many times as they'd like, but in their highest score would count on whether or not they made it. So there's a lot of sweat and nervousness going on.
I'll bet.
We had our booth set up to collect some different sort of data from them.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's first talk about how much better these people are than the regular person at Tetris.
Wow. Well, we thought we knew Tetris before we went there because we had about 400 undergraduates play an hour of Tetris in our laboratory because everybody knows Tetris, right? Mm-hmm. That's why we picked this task to start with. None of those people got past the levels, made it to the end of level 16. In fact, only about eight got to, actually only about three got to level 15. They all died. And we said, well, of course not, because, you know, at level 15, it takes 1 1/3 seconds for this piece to fall all 20 lines. And at level 16, it takes 1 second. So, of course, nobody can do that. Mm-hmm. And then we go to the Classic Tetris World Championship, and they start playing at level 18, where it takes 1 second to fall from top to bottom.
That's amazing. So let's talk about the steps that are involved. You have to see the board, you see the piece coming, you have to rotate it, then you have to put into position, and the best players are better than anybody at doing these things.
Yep, the best players are really, really good at that.
Do they play it differently from us? Do they look at the board and just know or decide they know where that piece is going quickly?
Yes. And this is all about what makes Tetris such an interesting thing for studying extreme expertise and these perceptual motor skills. All such skills are different, of course. Racing car drivers or laparoscopic surgeons are very different than Tetris players. But they're not different in the way they have to adapt, the way they have to learn to see things in advance before things happen. These people know when they see a Zoid, they know exactly how far to rotate it, how fast to move it, and all that stuff. Whereas people like me will be spending a lot of time maybe moving the Tetris piece around the board looking for a good place with it as it's falling. But these guys and gals, they just see the Zoid, know where to put it, and put it there by the shortest path, the minimum rotations, so that when it fits most tightly into the stack that they're building.
That's amazing. And so how can you learn from them what you'd like to know about brain function?
Ah, very good question. Well, mechanically, we have been, this coming year, we're going back with different tasks than we had before. So one thing which we were always a little bit annoyed us is that when they played Tetris at our booth, whenever we started at level zero, they'd be turning around in the chairs, talking to us as these pieces are falling luxuriously and having a conversation up until the thing got to about level 15, and then they start taking it seriously. This year, we're going to have them play their version of Speed Tetris, where the goal is not to get points, but to go from level 0 to 19 as fast as possible. And the winner is the one who gets the most points, but again, gets there as fast as they can. And that's important because then we'll have good data at the lower, slower levels from the experts that we can use to compare to our college students.
When you say good data, what kind of data are you collecting?
Oh, we collect everything. We've written our own version of Tetris, not for sale, not for distribution, we hasten to add.
Nuts.
We could get in trouble for that.
Curses.
But every single keystroke is timestamped to the nearest millisecond. Every single Zoid that's on the board, every Tetris piece on the board, every configuration, we know where the holes and the gaps are. We know everything and have timed everything. So we actually can play back our log files if we want to and watch a game be played.
Do you create this special game?
Yes, we did. One of my former doctoral students did, John Lidstedt. And actually, we now have a new version because it turned out that the old version didn't incorporate the right bugs. Believe it or not, I guess it's easy to believe that the people who programmed Tetris the first time around actually hadn't played Tetris themselves.
Yeah.
The ones in the 80s who basically created the original software. So they left behind bugs because they weren't good enough for the bugs to bother them. And it turns out that some of these bugs, apparently, Tetris lore has it, are what the extreme experts are exploiting to get to the higher level, places where, you know, the piece is falling from top to bottom in 1 second. How can you do that? That's too fast for most people to actually move a piece from the center to the side. But these people have all sorts of tricks for doing that.
Well, let me ask you about that. Do you find, like in all sports, there are naturals at the sport? Or can you be trained to be great at Tetris?
You know, until last year, I thought there was an easy answer to this question because we get it a lot. But last year, the person who won the world championship was a fellow named Joseph, who's about 17 years old at the time, and apparently he'd been playing Tetris for about the last 6 months. And he basically trashed the European champion, the Japanese champion, and the former world champion. So it was quite an exciting Tetris tournament last year.
So you think it's natural talent then?
At least not for most people. Joseph may have had something else going for him, and so we're very eager to get him back. We collected some data from him last year, and we'd like to get more data from him this year to see if we can pin it down. He played a lot of music and several musical instruments, and he thinks that may have something to do with his uncanny ability to play Tetris so well.
That is interesting. I understand that your research is funded by the Office of Naval Research. Why would the department, why would the Pentagon be interested in this?
Believe it or not, I get asked this a lot.
And your answer is?
Well, my answer is that there's a lot of types of expertise out there which do involve perception and action. And we are not very good at training those things. We don't really understand what do you have to do to train such things. And the first step on that is, really are these skills? What makes people so fast? How are people able to do that? So we believe that learning how people get good at Tetris and what they do when they are good at Tetris might lead us, for example, to design better laparoscopic trainers for Navy surgeons, or perhaps better displays and controls for Navy pilots. People who, you know, Navy has a heavy investment in these real-time dynamic decision-making tasks where you just can't sit around and do nothing. You have to make a decision, you know.
Yeah. They have to do that everywhere in the military. Maybe their training is being applied to operating drones and making quick decisions like that, or, you know, remote battlefield.
Exactly. And we do have some colleagues at other parts of the country who are studying drone pilots, probably not from the level of expertise that we are. But perhaps after we get to talk to them more about our Tetris findings, they will want to bring in more expert-level drone pilots.
So you don't have any idea how there is a transfer of skills here. If you're good at Tetris, you're good at something else and can be carried over.
Well, think about it this way, though. If you're good at playing chess or you're good at playing Go, if you're good at typing on a QWERTY keyboard or you're also good at writing script, the nature of expertise is that you become very, very good at something which most people are just sort of okay at. If you're good at four Olympic sports, are you also the best person for the broad jump? Probably not. Specialization seems to be the key here to getting really, really good. I mean, most people could get good at any one or two things they put their minds to, but yeah, we just don't have the time. We don't care enough about being, you know, the world's fastest touch typist. Or the world's best Tetris player.
Okay. Well, can you teach artificial intelligence to learn from what these people are doing?
Well, as a matter of fact, my doctoral student, Catherine Seibert, has models of Tetris playing, which she has been building to try to figure out what do these models tell us about decision-making in Tetris. Obviously, the models can move pieces at the blink of an eye, so we can't look at that component of it. But she's trying to isolate the decision-making component itself and how much this is influenced by things like time. It turns out that when we take one of her models, which can play over a million lines of Tetris, and we say, okay, let's see how well you're doing after 500 lines of Tetris. Well, 500 is a number we picked because that's sort of about the highest number that we ever had a human being play in our laboratory. So for Rinsler students, surviving for 500 lines would be very good. Well, it turns out that the models that are good in human skills start looking at like humans. So the models that play forever, they do this by playing one piece at a time, only clearing one line at a time. Mm. The ones who stop at 500 lines, they're more likely to get four line clears at once, which is what's called a Tetris, and you get 7.5 times as many points as you do clearing one line four times. So it's very interesting. The constraints of the task environment, the constraints of the situation, seem to force both the models and perhaps the humans to adopt similar strategies if they're only going to be playing for 500 lines.
Well, Dr. Gray, I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us. We're all more knowledgeable about Tetris. Wayne Gray, Professor of Cognitive Science at Rensselaer Polytech in Troy, New York. Thanks again for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
You're welcome. And when we come back, we're going to update on the state of Alzheimer's treatments. Are we ready to let go of the amyloid hypothesis, which really hasn't led to any drugs that really, really work? We'll talk about why that is after the break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Drug companies have been on a 30-year mission to develop
every memory you think you have of the past.
The house you grew up in, your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
Memory and Forgetting on Radiolab. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Develop a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. The usual suspects behind the disease are the amyloid plaques that build up in the brains of these patients. Remove the plaques, treat the disease. Well, for many decades, that has been the goal, and well, it certainly hasn't worked out that way. Drug after drug targeting amyloid has failed to improve the symptoms of Alzheimer's. The so-called amyloid hypothesis was not bearing out. But drug companies, they didn't give up. They kept developing and testing drugs that attacked amyloid from every angle, even perhaps at the expense of pursuing other avenues of treatment. This past summer, two more high-profile clinical trials of drugs to treat Alzheimer's, two more failed. That brings the number of successful treatments for the disease, which affects 5.8 million Americans. The number is zero. So are drug makers finally ready to move on from the amyloid hypothesis? And what led pharma companies to doggedly pursue it for decades in the first place? Here to try and help us answer those questions and to give us a sense of where the field goes from here are my next two guests. Dr. George Perry, professor of biology at the UT San Antonio and editor-in-chief of the journal Alzheimer's Disease. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Derek Lowe, a drug researcher and author of Science Magazine's In the Pipeline blog covering the pharmaceutical industry. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Lowe.
I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Perry, let me begin with you. It has been 30 years since the amyloid hypothesis was proposed, and there have really been zero successful treatments developed, you know, based on it. So how did we get there?
Well, when it was first proposed, the cascade hypothesis made a lot of sense based on the genetics of the disease. There are a small number of patients that have mutations that change the metabolism of amyloid and are associated with the chance of developing Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. These are mutations in the amyloid precursor protein, presenilin-1, presenilin-2. Also, the fact that Alzheimer's disease is defined by plaques and neurofibrillary tangles, which are made of another protein studied extensively called tau protein. Mm-hmm. And so the hypothesis was put forward that they were driving the disease. And also, under some circumstances, amyloid can be toxic in some culture systems. We've actually, with these most recent trials, really tested the hypothesis at the most rigorous degree, because we've actually removed the amyloid from the brain of some of the patients, and they haven't improved at all.
Wow. Dr. Lowe, how did the drug companies get hooked on the amyloid hypothesis in the first place?
Well, it's true that it really has been the best-looking hypothesis for many, many years. And you have to be very careful when you're going into the field developing a drug, because Alzheimer's is such a tough disease. You have to have a huge number of patients and dose them for years and years because it's so slow developing. So you have to be ready to spend at least $500 million and probably quite a bit more if you're going to go after it. So you have to go with the most solid-looking hypothesis you can possibly find. And that's pretty much been amyloid. There are a lot of other ideas, but nothing had that foundation. That said, I think we have pretty much beaten the amyloid hypothesis as far down as it can go.
So, Dr. Perry, Dr. Lowe, where do we go? What is the next best, or is there not a next best hypothesis of where to go?
I would like to add that we haven't ruled out that amyloid is important in the disease. The genetics,
true,
the fact that amyloid is both there and genetically linked to it shows that it's an important element in the disease, but it may not be an important element for targeting drugs.
That's absolutely true, yeah. I think when we get to the final explanation of Alzheimer's, it's going to have a lot about amyloid in it, but there's something more.
So we don't really understand the beginnings of Alzheimer's yet.
You've got it exactly right, mm-hmm, Ira. We don't understand the initial phase, and that initial phase doesn't just mean amyloid. It probably means something that is more linked to metabolism, more linked to the similarities with other chronic conditions.
Exactly, and that's the area that we're going to have to be able to target with a drug, because once the damage is done in an Alzheimer's patient's brain, I don't think you're ever really going to be able to reverse that. You have to know what the initial cause is, and we just don't.
Yeah, I'm less certain about that, about the idea that the brain couldn't repair itself to some extent if you remove the driving force.
Oh, that would be good.
What we know about the brain is there's a tremendous amount of plasticity and reconnections that happen in drastic conditions, like in small strokes. Patients recover, and parts of the brain is dead. So
that's,
I would imagine,
true,
if we could remove the driver, maybe people wouldn't recover to normalcy, but they would have increased function.
Mm-hmm. Let me go to the phones, because, of course, you can imagine how many people want to talk about that. Let me go to Savannah, Georgia. Hi, Rick. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for having me on the show.
Go ahead.
When it comes to dealing with the non-familial form of Alzheimer's disease, we don't have to look any further than the nutritional epidemiology for an answer. The evidence is clear that people whose cholesterol levels are higher in their midlife have much greater risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. We know that oxysterols, oxidized forms of cholesterol, and AGEs that form in animal products both have integral roles in producing the Alzheimer's pathology. When we look at people who live in the blue zones, who eat a diet that's very low in animal products, you see an almost total absence of neurodegenerative diseases like AD. I think it's kind of an illusion for us to look at finding the answer to a problem that's developed over a period of decades. It's like other chronic diseases. You have to think prevention. I'd like to know what the guests on your show think about that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Perry, any?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most exciting elements of Alzheimer's disease that's emerged in the last 5 to 10 years. The similarities to conditions like heart disease, which is that diet, exercise, stress reduction all make a tremendous difference in this. And, of course, I like your mention about the AGEs, the Advanced Aging Glycation products, because this is one of the things we identified in Alzheimer's disease almost 30 years ago.
Please tell us what that is.
AGEs are products of sugars reacting with proteins. They're increased during diabetes. They're part of the aging process, but when you have poor sugar control, such as diabetics have, that the sugars react with proteins and change their characteristics so they become non-functional. It plays an important role in cataract formation. It plays an important role in skin elasticity changes and connective tissue, like when you were talking earlier about the cartilage. Those type of tissues that don't renew themselves get modified by sugars.
There certainly is a connection between Alzheimer's and cholesterol, because one of the only genes that we can really tie definitively to Alzheimer's risk is called APOE4, and it is a lipoprotein handling gene, makes a lipoprotein. So there's some connection there, but at the same time, all the clinical trials and real-world experience with cardiovascular therapies and cholesterol-lowering drugs haven't shown that much of a connection with reducing Alzheimer's risk. So it's complex.
I'm sorry, Dr. Perry, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I wanted to jump in when the person was talking about the blue zones. Those are areas in which people are much healthier than average. Is also intervention studies, such as a finger study, which was done in Finland. It showed that if you change diet, you can lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease tremendously. So lifestyle plays a tremendous role in things that you can do, especially as mentioned earlier about cholesterol during middle age, obesity, et cetera, during middle age has a tremendous effect on your chance of having Alzheimer's disease. And studies that show that certain ethnic groups, African Americans and Hispanic Americans, are at higher risk of having the disease. All of this points to lifestyle being an important element.
Well, what about inflammation? Doctors talk about inflammation as being important in many diseases. I would imagine you'd have to look at that for Alzheimer's also.
And inflammation is tied to things like obesity and diet, et cetera. Stress causes inflammation. But its direct linkage is still less clear, just like the cholesterol linkage is
exactly
there, but it's not straightforward.
Exactly. Inflammation is such a common process, and it's associated with so many disease states, and indeed sometimes with aging itself, that it's really hard to disentangle that.
Let me go to the phones again. Let's go to Fort Dodge, Iowa. Greg, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was a couple of months ago at the Alzheimer's Association's International Research Conference out in L.A., and they were talking about some of the different types of related dementias. One of the newest ones was limbic predominant age-related TDP-43 encephalopathy, or late, and how much that's kind of changing our paradigm of what Alzheimer's disease is. So as we learn more about what some of these related systems are, how does that change where the research is heading, and does that kind of account for why some of the research in the past maybe wasn't as successful or maybe didn't reach the end point, is a better way to say it, than what we anticipated?
Dr. Perry, Dr. Lowe, how related are all of the other neurological?
You know that.
No, go ahead. I'll let you field that one.
Okay. Well, when you have age-related dementia, there's many different diseases. When I started in this field in the early 80s, there was sort of Alzheimer's disease and Pick disease, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've determined a number of different diseases that are all related. And this limbic condition has just been described as a condition of older individuals, meaning over 85 years old or so. Could that be important in the clinical trials as heterogeneity? Of course it is. But even in subgroup analysis, and I think Dr. Lowe is in a better position to be able to comment on this, There wasn't a miraculous cure for any of the groups that have been analyzed.
No, that's absolutely true. People have gone over the clinical data looking for some sort of group that looked more likely to have benefited from any of the treatments. It has been futile. Eli Lilly spent a really inordinate amount of money going back with one of their Alzheimer's amyloid antibodies and doing the whole trial again in what they thought was a more likely group, and nothing worked.
Let me then, in the few minutes we have remaining, let's talk about how we create a new roadmap then. What could be a new roadmap if we're not going to use the amyloid hypothesis? How do we handle this?
That's not an easy one to answer.
Yeah, that's not an easy one to answer at all.
Yeah.
I mean, from a drug discovery and drug development standpoint, I'm going to be a little contrarian and say right now, you might, if you're a drug company, you might not want to work on Alzheimer's for a bit. You might want to take that money and plow it into basic research or go off and work in other therapeutic areas where you could have a bigger impact on human health. Right now, it is such a tough field that you run a very high risk of spending a lot of money for no return.
Let me just jump in and say, I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
That would be an unfortunate situation that we'd have to have a hiatus on trials.
Oh, certainly.
Well, if you're a drug company and you're not making any money after all this research,
I mean, you're in the business of making money, right?
Yeah.
I know. They're in the business of making money and helping people.
Right.
I think that the key thing as the field, we need to be looking at new theories.
Yes.
For studying Alzheimer's disease.
All right, give me a couple of two or three new theories.
So, well, our own work, we focused on the issue of whether there's a metabolic element to the disease, whether it deals with mitochondrial problems and others. But one thing that we're doing together with Jim Trussard, a donor, is sponsoring a prize for new ideas in Alzheimer's disease, of which top prize will be $2 million.
Excellent. There are some ideas out there, and I really am curious to see how they come out, and I think that a lot of funding should go into non-amyloid ideas. It may just be a little bit longer before someone's willing to commit the time and effort to it on drug discovery. And as a drug discovery chemist myself, we need something to work on. We need a hypothesis that we can screen and test against.
Give me one of those ideas that you have not mentioned.
Well, there's one kicking around that amyloid might be a response of the brain to other stress, such as even infectious disease. I don't think there's a single infectious cause for Alzheimer's, but it might be that amyloid is sort of a sideshow to something else. Hmm. And this needs a lot more work put into it, but it's at least something different than the classic.
There are several companies doing trials on this related to periodontal disease.
Yes.
Our own work, when I was mentioning in studying mitochondria and metabolism, we think that the amyloid is a protective response to the disease.
Exactly.
We suggested this beginning about 20 years ago, that amyloid removal will have a detrimental effect for patients because it's playing an antioxidant role.
It's true. It may be that amyloid doesn't give you Alzheimer's, but Alzheimer's gives you amyloid.
Correct. And it follows the disease really well. And it was too simplistic. And why we developed this idea, we've initially pursued the amyloid hypothesis. And then as we did further experiments, we found that the amyloid was playing always a protective role to keep neurons alive.
Wow. Did doctors get together and just, you know, so throw out ideas about research, where we should head, to have meetings? I mean, it sounds like you could go anywhere with this.
That's the good part and the bad part.
Wow. Yes, but, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of orthodoxy pushing the amyloid idea. There was a recent article in Stat talking about the amyloid cabal and dealing with how many negative repercussions there were for people that questioned the amyloid hypothesis.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, drug companies put a lot of money down on these ideas, but in academia, people put their careers down on them too, and it can be very hard to change course.
It's very hard to come up for a new idea to break through after you've worked on something for so long. I can understand that. We come across that all the time when we talk about stuff here. But I want to thank both of you for opening our eyes to different ways of thinking. Dr. George Perry, professor of biology, UT San Antonio, and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. Dr. Derek Lowe, drug researcher and author of In the Pipeline blog for Science Magazine. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
And check back with us if you come up with a great idea, okay?
Will do.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break. And after the break, if you worry about air pollution in your office, you may think first about cleaning supplies, but more research is pointing to another culprit that might be you. We'll talk about why you may be the source of the air pollution after this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you work in an office, you know, especially one of those big open plan ones, you might have some gripes about your coworkers. Maybe they're too loud on the phone or they leave their coffee cup in the sink instead of washing it. But new research to be presented next week to the American Association of Aerosol Research has another thing you can blame on your colleagues, or they might blame on you. Indoor air pollution. Yep, it looks like we, just by showing up to work, are bringing with us high concentrations of volatile organic compounds and other kinds of air pollution, from the oils in our skin to our deodorant to the seemingly harmless act of peeling an orange. Yeah, and unlike that tuna someone just put through the microwave, you're not likely to smell these. Here to explain more is Dr. Brandon Bohr, Assistant Professor of Civil Engineering at Purdue University and co-author on that research. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Explain for us, what's the big deal with volatile organic compounds? What are they? Why should we be concerned?
So volatile organic compounds are a class of chemicals that want to exist as a gas or vapor. And they come from many different sources in the indoor environment. We know that many furniture items and building materials and consumer products can off-gas VOCs to the air. This is fairly well established. We're also looking now at how people release VOCs into the air in an office environment. And we found that basically the human body is a big source of different types of VOCs. We call it, or we refer to it as the volatilome. So we know that there's about 2,000 VOCs associated with the human body. We know that exhaled breath contains many different types of VOCs, about 1,000. And these molecules are produced in our bodies as a result of metabolism through bacteria in our gut, food or medicine that we may consume, as well as smoking or vaping.
I'm just shocked here about all the things our bodies are giving off. Were you surprised at that number? You said 1,000 VOCs from our breath alone?
Yeah, so research on exhaled breath has shown that there can be about 1,000 different VOCs in our breath, which is quite fascinating if you think about it. And I think from my perspective, I never really thought of as people as a significant source of VOCs. Most of the attention has always been on what's off-gassing from the floor,
right,
or paint on the walls, mattresses and sofas and things like that. But you know, recent research has shown that really people are a pretty important source of many different types of VOCs, and that's through our breath, our skin, and our sweat, and the personal care products that we apply to our bodies, essentially to make us smell nice.
Let's get into some of those, but let me first remind our audience, if you want to talk about you and your skin and your air pollution in your office, our number is 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry. Let's get into some of those. Let's get into first what you just mentioned, some of the skincare products. What VOCs are being given off there?
So an important class of VOCs that are released from personal care products like deodorant or lotions or hairspray are called siloxanes. And we found levels of many siloxanes, including one called dimethylcyclopentasiloxane, or D5, to peak in the morning after people walked into the office with freshly applied deodorant. And our findings are similar to a recent study at the University of California, Berkeley, where they also found these siloxanes to be in great abundance in a classroom and to actually be the most abundant VOC released from students in that classroom. And along with siloxanes, we see VOCs referred to as monoterpenes. And these are added to these products to give them a pleasant scent, like citrus fruit, pine trees, and lavender.
If enough people enter an office, a closed space with enough of this on them, could they be violating some sort of standard for VOCs?
That's a good question. I'm not exactly sure about that. I don't know if there's any standards for emissions from people, but I think the concern really would be in environments where there is a high density of people.
Right.
And this would include an open plan office, a classroom. I just taught a class. We have 90 students, so you have a lot of people in a small volume of air, movie theaters, and so forth. So you have a lot of people present. We're all emitting these different VOCs. And if that particular space is not well ventilated, concentrations can build up quite rapidly. And as in our office, we see that concentrations of many of these VOCs can be factor 5 to factor 10 greater indoors than in the surrounding outdoor environment.
I don't know how to ask this next question gingerly, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. Are we talking about something different than body odor here? Or is this body odor basically, in essence, those smells you're talking about?
Yes, yeah, certainly some of these VOCs are associated with body odor and sweat. In sweat particularly, we have a number of organic acids, acetic acid, lactic acid. But then there's others that we would not necessarily detect the odor. Their concentrations are too low, but they're still important.
You know, I was surprised to see there's some interesting chemistry that happens just from peeling an orange.
Yeah, so this is very exciting. So an orange, you know, in the skin contains a lot of oils. And when you peel the orange or a mandarin, you release VOCs into the air. And these are called monoterpenes. In an orange, the prominent monoterpene is called limonene. And limonene is very reactive with ozone. So we know ground-level ozone is a big player outdoors in atmospheric chemistry. But in an office environment, it's delivered indoors through the ventilation system. And this is because we often have some amount of outdoor air that we must provide to meet office ventilation standards. So we have this ozone that's entering the office space. You peel the orange, release these terpenes. The two react together. And what ends up happening is that you produce very small airborne particles, which we also refer to as aerosols. And this process is called new particle formation. And we know that this is very important in influencing outdoor air quality, as well as the formation of clouds. But now that we see that it can happen in an occupied office environment. So every time that we peeled an orange in the office, and my doctoral students did this quite many times, we generated a substantial number of particles, on the order of tens of thousands of particles in each cubic centimeter of indoor air. So we're essentially seeing that the VOCs coming out of the orange are reacting with the ozone, and we're creating new particles, and these particles are as small as a single nanometer, which is 1/1,000,000,000 of a meter.
Wow, let's go to the phones because they have lit up after the oranges came out. The phones lit up. Let's go to Casey in Kansas City. Hi, Casey.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Question about possible solutions to VOCs. We know that air purifiers, you know, the machinery works, but I'd like to know both of your thoughts on moss, M-O-S-S, as in the stuff that grows on the ground, both real and preserved moss. I'd like to know your thoughts on the effectiveness of moss in absorbing VOCs.
Good question.
Thanks, Casey. So there's a good amount of research on what we refer to as biofiltration, using plants to effectively filter the air. And in biofiltration, you draw air through the soil of the plant, and it can be a complex array of plants that are growing through some sort of wall configuration. And there's a number of large-scale biofiltration systems out there. And those have shown to be somewhat effective at removing VOCs. Just having potted plants in the office space itself or any indoor environment are not going to clean the air. So you have to draw air through the soil. When that happens, a bacteria in the soil can help break down some of those VOCs.
Now, you talked about the problem happening when it interacts with the ozone. Ozone is everywhere in a city, right, from cars and things like that?
Yep.
Is there any way to filter out the ozone?
Or is it just
just going to be there.
Yeah, it is challenging, and we do want to provide outdoor air to an office environment and really any indoor environment to help dilute concentrations of VOCs and other pollutants that are generated indoors. But when we do that, we do deliver ozone, nitrogen oxides, and ambient particulate matter indoors. With particles, there's great filtration strategies to remove them from the air. You can buy a very high efficiency filter to capture those particles. With ozone and VOCs, it can be a little bit more challenging. There's some advanced air cleaning strategies that you can deploy in a ventilation system to help scrub out those contaminants.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Everybody would like to talk about it. Joe in Palo Alto. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Quick question. I keep hearing a lot about VOCs these days, and I'm curious, what are the actual demonstrated health impacts of VOCs?
Good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. So we know that indoors are exposed to a complex mixture of pollutants, and this certainly includes VOCs, and there's many hundreds of VOCs, but we also have a diverse spectrum of particles, ozone and nitrogen oxide. So when we talk about the health effects of indoor air pollution, I always want to emphasize that we're exposed to a complex mixture of contaminants, and we need to look at how that complex mixture affects our health and well-being. With VOCs, we know there's a lot of research out there that fragrance consumer products that we use inside, such as deodorant, perfume, air fresheners, cleaning products, they can cause headaches, chest tightness, irritation of our airways and eyes, reduce pulmonary function, and worsen asthma symptoms. These siloxanes that I mentioned that are found in personal care products, we know that they can bioaccumulate and they're persistent in the environment.
Are the emissions that people give off in a group setting, let's say you have a number of people together, would it be greater than the VOCs that gets outgassed from the furniture or the carpeting?
Yes, that's what we found in our particular office environment, which is in a relatively new building, that it's really the people that are driving the emissions of VOCs. And we see this because we're tracking occupancy. So we're looking at how many people are in the office throughout the day, and we're doing that by embedding temperature sensors in each chair. So when people sit down, the temperature goes up and we can see that they're there. So with that information, we can compare the levels of many different VOCs when there's a lot of people in the office and then in the evening when there's nobody in there. And for many different VOCs, we see that the levels are much greater during these occupied periods. So they're coming from people, from our breath, skin, right, sweat, and the personal care products.
And I would imagine in the morning would be the best because they are fresh, right, with all these things on their skin.
Yeah, that's an interesting time because we often apply deodorant when we leave our house and go to work. And what we see in our office is that there's a spike in the concentration of these siloxanes in the early morning. So all the students come in this case, we have graduate students working there with freshly applied deodorant or other personal care products. The emissions spike in the morning and then they drop off over time. And this, could present a concern if you're trying to work at that point in time.
No concern that this is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. We have a submission from Phil in Auburn through our Science Friday Vox Pop app, and he's more worried about the cleaning products that might enter the space after hours.
For many offices, ventilation stops after hours. Then when janitors or cleaning people work, the air becomes more polluted without fresh air entering the office.
Brandon, did you research at that, look at that possible problem?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think custodial staff is, perhaps people that we may not think about, and certainly very important because they are in the buildings in the late evening. And, at that time, the ventilation rate often is reduced for energy saving purposes. So if they're using products like Pine Sol, we know that emits a lot of different VOCs, including monoterpenes. And we did some measurements this past summer of researchers at Indiana University, and we tested different cleaning products, including Pine Sol, and we see, very elevated levels of VOCs. But what's also interesting is not just the VOCs, but when you have some ozone coming in to the office, the two will react, as I just mentioned, like with the orange, and you could end up forming these small particles. So sometimes with cleaning products and other VOC sources, you have to be concerned both about that VOC and then the reaction products that form, which may be more toxic than the VOC that was originally emitted.
Is there any metering or something I can buy and stick in my office to know if the levels are getting too high?
Yes, there's a lot of focus now on low-cost air quality sensors. For VOCs, there's nothing that's really going to speciate and tell you the different types of VOCs that are present. We have sensors that can give you a rough indicator about the total mass of VOC in the office space or any indoor environment. But I would say that those are not terribly reliable. In our particular study, we used a very expensive instrument that, you know, is for research purposes that tells us all the different VOCs that are in the air and you know, separates them very nicely.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Quick question from Sonny in Pittsburgh. Hi, Sonny. Sonny, are you there? I think the lights went out on that call. Sonny wanted to know, what are the top three things we can do?
Oh, that's a great question. So I would say that the best strategies for maintaining good indoor air quality in your home or your office, the first is to minimize the sources of indoor pollutants, to minimize the emissions. In an office environment, that's challenging if people are producing a lot of the VOCs. But if you're looking at personal care products or scented products, you could try to find products that emit less quantities of VOCs. The second thing we can do, and I think this is often very effective, is to improve the ventilation of the building, basically allowing the indoor space to breathe better. And we can do this by providing greater quantities of outdoor air, and this air should be filtered. And then, you know, an environment like an office or a classroom, the amount of ventilation that you provide should be scaled with occupancy. So if people are a source of VOCs and there's more people in the room, we should provide more outdoor air.
And the last thing?
The last thing would be filtration and air cleaning. So you can go to your home improvement store and buy a high efficiency filter to capture particles. You can use a portable air purifier in your home or office, and then perhaps some other air cleaning technologies in the ventilation system.
Dr. Bohr, you've been very helpful. Brandon Bohr is assistant professor of civil engineering at Purdue in West Lafayette, Indiana. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Ira. It's great to talk to you today.
Nice to have you. You're welcome. One last thing. We want to hear your voice on Science Friday with the Science Friday Vox Pop app. We've been asking you if you thought about relocating due to flooding, fire, or other climate change-related hardships. Now we want to know from those of you who have relocated, how did you manage it? Was it easy or hard when you relocated? Let us know on the Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. We want to know from those of you who have relocated, how did you manage it? Was it easy or hard? On our Science Friday Vox Pop app, wherever you get your apps. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.